Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 22nd, and here are some of the stories we're covering. Kenya is accused of failure to protect women and girls from abuses during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Women were also at increased risk of violence because of their increased social isolation, spending a lot of time in the home, in the house, being stuck with someone who is abusing you.
East Africa community intelligence chiefs meet in Rwanda. Rights groups warn Botswana's government against making COVID-19 vaccination mandatory. A photo exhibition in Nigeria to mark International Day of Peace. And the U.S. says Ethiopia and Tigray actors can avoid sanctions by ending the ongoing conflict.
The United States is ready to help mobilize assistance for Ethiopia to recover and revitalize its economy. Those meaningful steps include agreeing to negotiations without preconditions and accepting an invitation to initial talks.
A startup in Benin builds computers made out of jerry cans and cryptocurrency trading in Kenya. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A prominent human rights group has accused Kenya's government of failing to adopt preventive measures to protect women and girls during the COVID-19 pandemic lockdowns and curfews. Human Rights Watch says the government failed to ensure access to health, economic, and social support services, adding to an increase in sexual and other forms of abuses against women and girls. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
In a 61-page report entitled I Had Nowhere to Go, Human Rights Watch documented how the government failed victims of gender-based violence as the government introduced lockdowns, issued restrictions of the movement of people to combat the spread of the coronavirus. Agnes Odhiambo is human rights researcher on women issues. Speaking Tuesday at a press conference in Nairobi, she said the pandemic has increased violence against women as they were confined to their homes.
Women were also at increased risk of violence because of their increased social isolation, spending a lot of time in the home, in the house, being stuck with someone who is abusing you. Many women also did not get information on how they could get help during the lockdowns. The breakdown of community structures for support and networks in communities also meant that many women really did not have somewhere to go and get help.
Human Rights Watch investigators spoke to 13 survivors, community workers, experts and officials working with the police program meant to combat violence against women. Victims told the rights group they were sexually abused, faced beatings and were thrown out of their homes. Young girls were forced to marry at a younger age and to undergo female genital mutilation. The investigators found that most survivors did not report the abuse to the authorities because they believed they would not receive assistance. Others believed they would have to bribe authorities to get assistance and could not pay. Beverly Ongaro works at the office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights. She told journalists they would work with the Kenyan authorities to ensure survivors get protection and justice.
It provides us insight on the barriers survivors face and what needs to be done by duty bearers from survivors' perspective and ultimately for the government to comply with its human rights obligation as under the treaties and under Kenyan law, particularly the constitution. And allow me to reiterate once more that when we tolerate GBV, somehow it violates the, not somehow, actually it violates the human rights of the survivors and also their humanity.
Kenya's government has passed a number of laws in response to gender-based violence. It also has established guidelines for responding to such violence by police, specialized medical personnel and justice officials. But perpetrators of these abuses often find a way around the rules, using money and connections. Human Rights Watch is calling on the government to build a solid right-based framework to protect and give justice to women and girls in the future. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The chiefs and directors of intelligence of East Africa Community, the EAC member states, are meeting in Rwanda to discuss ways of working together to establish peace in the region. These senior officers say the EAC should not have to rely on developed countries to handle their own security threats. Yuji Uwimana has details from Rwanda's capital, Kigali.
During a two-day regional meeting, chiefs and directors of intelligence from the East African Community states first reviewed security in the region. Recent security threats included the recent shooting that killed four and injured six near the French embassy in Tanzania. Observers say the incident showed that more must be done to ensure peace and stability in a region which aims at promoting the free movement of its people. The chief of defense staff of the Rwanda Defense Force, General Jean Bosco Kazura, urged the participants to strive for self-reliance while handling security in the region.
We need to find a solution to our own problems. We don't have to wait for some people coming from outside to tell us what to do and find solutions to our own problems. And having a gathering like this one, I believe this is an opportunity to make sure that what our principals want, this is what we shall do.
General Jean Bosco Kazura reminded the participants that security depends on harmony among all the members of the region.
We all need to make sure that the Eastern African countries should live together in peace and harmony. And this is why we are here. And your role in it is very important. We all know that sometimes there are here and there some complications, but this is why we are here. This is why we are in this institution. Whether we like it or not, time comes and also time goes away. But our countries shall always live.
The meeting is taking place while security experts are warning that COVID-19 has given insurgents time to reorganize themselves. Colonel Rafaele Kibiwote Kipto, the East African Community Defense Liaison Officer, said that intelligence organs need to be more vigilant and cooperative.
The meeting should come up with ways to try and ensure that the efforts that the respective armed forces and regional organizations have put in place to ensure that, you know, these elements of, you know, instability or terrorism elements are contained.
Some say the task of ESC intelligence agencies may become a bit harder in the future if the Democratic Republic of the Congo joins the bloc. The United Nations say there are around 191 armed groups in the forest and valleys of the DRC. It applied to be the seventh member state after Kenya, Tanzania, Uganda, and South Sudan, Burundi, and Rwanda, which were all represented at the meeting. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The U.S. government is urging the Ethiopian government, the rebel group Tigray People's Liberation Front, and other warring factions to end the conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region and allow humanitarian aid to reach millions in need of assistance. Unless the conflict starts, says the U.S., key officials could be facing U.S. travel and financial sanctions, Mohammed Yusuf reports.
Speaking at an online press briefing Monday, Brian Hunt, the acting Deputy Assistant Secretary for East Africa, say the U.S. government wants to see an end to the 10-month conflict in Tigray.
If the government of Ethiopia and the TPLF take meaningful steps to enter into talks for a negotiated ceasefire and allow for unhindered humanitarian access, a different path is possible. The United States is ready to help mobilize assistance for Ethiopia to recover and revitalize its economy. Those meaningful steps include accepting African Union-led mediation efforts, designating negotiation teams, agreeing to negotiations without preconditions, and accepting an invitation to initial talks.
Hunt also said the parties should allow convoys of trucks carrying humanitarian aid to reach Tigray and restore essential services to the region. On Friday, U.S. President Joe Biden signed an executive order that paves the way for sanctions on Ethiopian government officials, Eritrea, and other groups involved in the Tigray conflict. Hunt said other tools to press for a peaceful resolution to the conflict have failed.
This conflict has already sparked one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world today, with more than 5 million people requiring assistance, of which over 900,000 are already living in famine conditions. For far too long, the parties to this conflict have ignored international calls
to initiate discussions to achieve a negotiated ceasefire, and the human rights and humanitarian situations have worsened.
The U.S. government say the sanctions program will not affect personal remittances to non-sanctioned persons. Humanitarian assistance and international and local organizations' activities. Ethiopian army troops invaded Tigray last November following months of rising tension between the government of Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Tigray's ruling party, the TPLF. Eric Woodhouse, Deputy Assistant Secretary for the U.S. State Department's Counter-Threat Finance and Sanctions Bureau, say the sanctions aim to warn sides to find a solution to the conflict rather than using the military.
Sanctions are a tool that seek to change the behavior of the targets. These measures impose tangible costs on human rights abusers and perpetrators of conflict. By imposing such costs, the United States seeks to send a signal that such actions are not without consequence.
Professor Chacha Nyaigoti Chacha, a specialist in diplomacy and international relations at the University of Nairobi, says sanctions are not always effective.
Some of the leadership, when such sanctions are threatened to be applied, they don't care. So sanctions might not work because the idea of sanctioning, the idea of stopping the opportunities from flowing to the country which you are sanctioning, is to make them feel the pinch and then come or change their trend. But sometimes they don't, and they don't care.
In a letter to Biden, Prime Minister Abiy defended his actions in Tigray, saying his government has stabilized the region and addressed humanitarian needs amid a hostile environment created by the TPLF. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 22nd. Human rights activists in Botswana have warned the government against making COVID-19 vaccination mandatory. This comes as some citizens reject the jab on religious grounds. From Habaruni, reporter Kundise Dube has the details.
Human rights organization Botswana Network on Ethics, Law and HIV/AIDS, or BONELA, says it is prepared to take the government to court if compulsory COVID-19 vaccination is introduced. BONELA director Cindy Gelemi says there are other ways to fight the coronavirus.
Vaccination is not the only alternative. There are other strategies for curbing the spread of COVID-19 that have been documented to be effective. These include wearing masks, social distancing, and sanitizing, among others. There isn't enough justification for limiting rights in this instance.
Gelemi says prohibiting citizens from accessing certain services due to their decision not to vaccinate violates their rights.
Not allowing people who are not vaccinated to access certain services or to access certain spaces is a violation of their human rights. It is discrimination of the highest order. And should we be aware as BONELA that there are people who are being exposed to such treatment, we will take the necessary measures, including legal redress.
She adds the government should, instead of considering mandatory vaccination, educate the public about the benefits of inoculation.
Getting vaccinated for COVID-19 does not stop one from getting the virus. Neither does it stop one from transmitting the virus. And it also does not stop one from being sick from the virus. Therefore, there isn't enough justification for us to make vaccination mandatory. What we are advocating for as a human rights organization is that governments, including other critical players such as NGOs, should focus on educating people about the importance of vaccination so that people can make their own decisions voluntarily to vaccinate.
The government admits some people have refused to take the jab, with the majority citing religious reasons. Recently, the Minister of Education, Fidelis Mulao, said 90% of teachers had been vaccinated, but some had refused to get the shots. Despite a rise in vaccination hesitancy, the government says receiving the COVID-19 doses remains voluntary. Botswana is looking to accelerate its vaccination program after receiving 500,000 doses of the AstraZeneca and Sinovac vaccines in the past 2 weeks. For VOA, this is Mqondisi Dube in Gaborone, Botswana.
The Nigerian Aid Group Center for Civilians in Conflict marked this year's International Day of Peace yesterday with a photo exhibit on the conflict in the country's northeast. The photograph depicts some of the civilians caught up in the 12-year conflict. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The photo exhibit opened Tuesday morning at the Abuja Thought Pyramid Art Center. Around 150 art lovers arrived in batches to see images taken from scenes of the Boko Haram insurgency and the communities affected by it. Art lover Hilary Essien was one of those who attended the exhibit. She says the photos tell a story of pain and survival.
The actual people being here and seeing that these people are out there, away from their homes, away from their families, fearing for their lives, it's just really touching, to be honest.
Nigerian photojournalist Damilola Onofwa took these photos for non-profit Center for Civilians in Conflict and says he's very happy about the effect the pictures are having on viewers.
When I create these works, I only create it because I want people to know. I want to share the stories of people that I'm photographing. And when other people see it, I see how much impact it has on them, and that makes me very happy.
Nigeria has been battling the Boko Haram insurgency for 12 years. The fighting has claimed an estimated 350,000 lives, according to the United Nations Development Programme, UNDP, and displaced millions of others. But Boko Haram is not the only group threatening the northeast. Armed criminal groups are becoming more active, often kidnapping people for ransom. Communal clashes over grazing lands are leading to raids and burnings of villages. The Center for Civilians in Conflict says the exhibit aims to raise awareness about these issues with the view of addressing them. Benson Olugbo is a director of the center.
The exhibition tries to chronicle the lives of ordinary Nigerians who are trying everything possible to maintain the peace. So the idea is to use photograph as a means of advocacy and also to remind the federal government that they have a primary responsibility to maintain law and order, to protect lives and properties, and to ensure that peace reigns.
The International Day of Peace is observed every year on September 21st. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Blow Lab, a startup in Benin, is turning plastic jerry cans into computers using recycled components and distributing them to the public at a low cost. Anne Unzuanku visited the startup in Cotonou, Benin, in this story narrated by Moki Edwin Kinzika.
Atu Datjo is a student in Cotonou, Benin, where innovation and recycling meet. For the past year, he has been using a computer he built himself. It is made from a plastic jerry can, recycled materials, and parts from an old or broken computer to build what would become the computer's motherboard and hard drive. Locals call it jerry after the name of the containers. With royalty-free software installed, it is as good as new. And most importantly, cheaper. You can find a complete office computer between 300 and 350,000 in West African CFA franc, the local currency, he said. But with the components we bought, with the help of the startup, we spent about 100 to 150,000 CFA franc to have this computer. Biolab, a digital innovation lab working in the fields of education and digital technology, makes these jerry computers. The startup regularly organizes workshops to teach people how to make their own computers for free. Medad Agbayazon is the founder of Biolab. He says, in addition to giving people access to cost-effective products, the trainers want to help develop skills in innovation.
Le deuxième objectif, c'est justement celui de la stimulation de la de la.
The second objective is to stimulate creativity in children. He says when they learn to do these gerunds, they also learn how to solve problems they are confronted with in their environment using the material or the means they have at their disposal. Experts believe that the computer is increasingly an indispensable working tool and that initiatives such as biolabs should be encouraged. Alicia Dai is with OpenSea, an organization focusing on digital transformation companies. A computer is a door to a world of opportunities, Shaddai says, and making it accessible to the greatest number of people is beneficial for these people and for society in general. He says Biolab's effort is positive. The training to learn how to build a gerry is offered for free, but participants must find the components to build their own computers themselves. Biolab has been in operation for 4 years, and founders say that hundreds of people have already taken advantage of the training sessions and built their computer. The startup is now working to make these self-built computers available to schools located in remote areas. With that, Biolab says it would bridge the digital gap one gerry at a time. For Anne Zwanke in Cotonou, Benin, Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News.
Blockchain data platform Chain Analysis has ranked internet using Kenyans as the world's top peer-to-peer or P2P cryptocurrency traders. The group's survey shows that many Kenyans use this form of trading because they don't have access to centralized exchanges. Lenny Ruvaga looks at the challenges and what this means for the industry in Kenya.
Tony Mongera is the CEO of Healthland Spa. Today, Mongera is going over the books of accounts. For the last 5 years, Mongera has been a pioneer in accepting cryptocurrencies as a means of paying for services at his establishment. On average, services at the spa cost around $30, which according to Mongera can be paid through Bitcoin. Mongera says that introducing Bitcoin as a means of payment has proven quite popular with his clients.
Many customers are also saying that we are accepting Bitcoin, which is a modern form of payment, and that they say, where do they come? They can enjoy our massage services and pay using Bitcoin because it's safe, secure, and also very convenient.
A recently released report by Chain Analysis ranks Kenya as a leader in peer-to-peer trading of cryptocurrencies. One of the major parameters used in the Global Crypto Adoption Index was the number of cryptocurrency deposits and number of internet users. Mongera says clients have to download a blockchain wallet to enable payment. He explains the steps on how payment through cryptocurrencies is processed.
In a blockchain wallet, you put $30, it converts into Bitcoin. Once it converts, now you send to me, then I receive. When I receive the payment, now you're good to go. You can now leave after doing the massage services.
David Kitonga is the co-founder of Bitcoin KE, an organization that was begun 3 years ago and whose aim is to facilitate peer-to-peer trading, including the education of users on blockchain technology and cryptocurrencies. On average, Bitcoin KE brings together around 70,000 visitors to its platform daily. Kitonga says that most peer-to-peer trading occurs due to the aspect of anonymity.
In Kenya, peer-to-peer is actually the easiest way for people to get into cryptocurrencies. So right now, there are no centralized exchanges, so most people opt to go the peer-to-peer way. So these exchanges are not controlled locally, for example. They cannot be shut down. So it's much easier for people to just transact between each other.
Michael Kimani is a blockchain analyst from PESA Africa, an organization that monitors cryptocurrencies worldwide with a focus on Africa. Kimani says that the fact that cryptocurrencies are unregulated by a central authority could pose a big challenge.
The central bank issue that has prevented companies or startups from building in Kenya. So it's made it really difficult for Kenyans to have formal channels of accessing cryptocurrencies. And this has created the proliferation of things like cryptocurrency scams. So one of the reasons the peer-to-peer volumes are going up in Kenya is because there are no formal channels, and the only way you can buy is through the peer-to-peer marketplaces and channels.
Mongera can only hope that his choice to add cryptocurrencies as a means of payment will keep attracting more clientele to his growing business. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Wednesday morning, September 22nd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte